Welcome to the MRI Cast. These podcasts focus on various current topics in MRI. We invite you to ask questions via the website and even suggest topics for future MRI Cast. The opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect standards in clinical practices, nor should they be considered as medical advice. This program is made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the MRI Cast. With me today are my co-host, Kristen Harrington. Hello, Kristen.
Hello, everybody.
And Dr. Howard Raleigh from the great state of Wisconsin. Hello, Howard.
It's great to be here, Bill, your blue-collar neuroradiologist in the house.
All right. It gives me chills all over my body.
I don't want to think about that, Bill.
Well, it's actually kind of cool here today. And with us, our host or guest for today, rather, is Dr. Carl Vegan, also from Wisconsin. How are you, Carl? Welcome.
I'm good, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Carl.
Yes, Bill. My name is Carl Vegan, and I'm an MRI physicist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I work in the Department of Radiology. And a lot of the work I do is clinical MR physics support as well, and I do quite a bit with MR safety in our department.
He's really understating that. He is MR safety in our department and helps us in all respects and protocol development and all those troublesome situations with unknown objects and so forth. And I'd also like to point out that Carl has just a spectacular singing voice, so hopefully we'll get to hear that a little bit later.
Oh, wow. I can't wait. Kristen, try to control yourself and don't join him if you don't.
Thanks so much, Bill. I love all the compliments you give me, but I do want to put in a request for a song for one of the answers, if you don't mind, Carl.
Okay, we'll see what we can do.
Well, in today's MRI cast, we're going to be discussing SAR, the specific absorption rate, and then also SED, standing for specific energy dose, which is also known as SAE. Specific. I keep getting it reversed. I know.
I'm going to help you out here, Bill, even though you're me. Absorbed energy.
Okay. Thank you. And then we'll also be discussing B1 plus RMS. So let's start with SAR. And Carl, if you wouldn't mind, give us a short, brief, concise explanation of exactly what that is.
Sure, Bill. So, yeah, SAR is a measure of radio frequency energy, more precisely, power deposition in our human subjects or our human patients that we scan with MRI. It comes about from the radio frequency pulses, the fields that we transmit into our patients. It's measured in watts per kilogram. So watts are a power, and it's normalized to the weight of the patient. And it's not a unique thing to MRI, but it's a very useful feature for MRI to measure how much power that we're putting into our patients.
You know, I've seen, speaking of not being unique to MRI, I have noticed in, because we really don't get printed user manuals anymore, but in material that I see online, if you're looking through, say, for example, the user manual of an iPhone or any mobile phone for that matter, you'll see a section on SAR. I've even seen it with the cordless phones. And so I've also read that it's the unit of measure that's used for radio frequencies within a certain frequency range. Is that pretty much correct? Did I understand that correctly when I read that?
Yes, I think that's correct.
You know, we talk about SAR a lot of times, and we use SAR as a metric for heating. It, again, is relative, though, to tissues. And sometimes I see people, or I've seen it associated with the topic of burns. And in also with stuff I've read, I've found that it apparently, and I know I've seen this definitely in data, that burns and SAR are somewhat related, but they're not exactly related. In other words, you can get burned even in a lower SAR mode, because burns tend to occur from other things other than energy being applied to the body. So Carl, I mean, is there a difference, or how are they related?
Yes. Well, SAR is typically used to describe the amount of whole body power that's deposited. And so we think, for example, the limit of the first operating mode And for whole body imaging, a limit of 4 watts per kilogram. And that's really an average over the whole body. But you can also have regional SAR values and local SAR values. And so if you do have a very, very high, much higher local SAR value, you could get a burn because of that. But as you mentioned, you can, even with, if you're running the scanner in say a normal or a low SAR mode, you could still have a situation where you have something that's not supposed to happen where you do get a burn. And if you do have higher SAR values, you probably will have a higher chance for a burn or just a higher severity of a burn. But as you mentioned, you can still get burns even with low SAR values.
You know, another way to think about it, it's sort of at least more intuitive maybe for me is, you know, we're putting in the RF tuned at the Larmor frequency, so 63.5 megahertz for 1.5T, for example, whereas other types of radio frequency energy, like a microwave in your kitchen, that's operating at a different frequency that might be more tuned to actually intentionally heat up tissue like your lunch.
Well, we certainly, you know, I've always said, you know, it'd be nice if you could, back in the days when we had long scans, if you could just put your lunch in there with the patient and say, here, hold this for me, you know, and then when they're through. But
you're bad, Bill.
Well, I'm just thinking of ways to be efficient, you know, with the energy. And I've actually heard, there was something Carl mentioned that I've heard this before, that if you have a burn and you're in a higher SAR mode, then the consequences might be more significant. Is that what I understand you to say, that, you know, if you get a burn, it can be worse than if you're in a higher SAR?
Yes, I think it can be. I mean, it's not, again, as you mentioned, you can get a burn even with a low SAR value, but, you know, if you turn up the dial and you put in more power to your patient, you could definitely affect the severity of a burn.
You know, we had, thinking back to the old days, back when I started in MRI, which is in 1980, if I've known your business, but back in those days, you could, the limit for SAR was 0.4 watts per kilogram. Now, we didn't have fast or turbo spin echo back then. Our scans, you know, you could time it with a calendar. You know, the 20-minute scan was nothing unusual. And we really didn't see, obviously at that, we didn't see patient warming. And we really didn't see a burn unless you had, for example, like a wire or a lead that formed a loop and then came in contact with the patient. Then you've got a resonant loop in there. And back in those days, that's about the only way you could get a burn.
Yes. Well, you can definitely with any kind of, back then or even today, any kind of metal or something that's on the skin, that can basically, you can think of that as focusing the RF, and that can cause a burn in that location. Some of the common locations that we hear about is if you have skin-to-skin contact, that's another location where, again, you can get a very high, you can think of it as a high local SAR value in that location, and you can get a burn there as well.
Yeah, Bill and I, we talk about that as far as being like focused energy, like if your fingertips are touching and they're making a large loop, then versus your hands actually being clasped or something like that. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, whenever you have, if you have skin lightly touching, you can basically, is a point where, you can get those high local SAR values. I would say, as much as possible, you probably want to avoid hands clasping if you can as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely that can be a better situation than if you're lightly touching.
And as far as skin-to-skin contact, Bill and I always recommend, you know, just wearing scrub pants with no pockets and a gown with no, you know, metal on them whatsoever to prevent that skin-to-skin contact.
And I guess it might be important to comment that the, you know, the SAR is the rate of energy deposition in watts per kilogram. And so a higher SAR means you're delivering energy at a faster rate. And it's an attempt to look at the thermal load going into the patient from that energy. So it isn't directly related to burns, but makes it probably more likely in a high SAR situation. And we'll get to how that relates to the SED or SAE metrics, which are more of a cumulative dose of energy put into the patient.
Yeah, and I think one thing that we have to think about when Bill talks about he started an MR in 1980, none of your business, I think that it's important to recognize that now with, like he said, he didn't have Fastspin Echo, faster ways of imaging. Now we have longer, you know, turbo factors. The scans are back to back because the reconstructors are, and so I think we're depositing a lot more heat over a shorter period of time.
Well, we're not giving the patient a chance to cool off, to release that energy. I mean, I've heard it explained as, you know, you've got energy into the tissue, and then the patient is going to, in fact, we need to probably talk about this, it's going to release that energy, and then that's in cooling. And if the input is greater than the output, then patient warming is going to occur. Carl, would you not agree that, I mean, patient warming, at least based on what Kristen just said, patient warming is something that is common and can be expected in today's technology.
Yes, I think some degree of patient warming can be. I think it's a lot of times it's more common to sort of have it regionally, perhaps where kind of SAR itself can be very non-uniform. It's not, we talk about it as an average, but it's actually, there's parts of the body where it's higher and parts where it's lower.
Is that the hot spots? Is that what you're talking
about?
Yeah,
yes, correct. When you talk about hot spots, it's again, a very non-uniform phenomenon, and you can get hot spots where it is. Now, as far as warming, like the core body temperature, we typically, with the levels of SAR that we're regulated to, we don't really see core body temperatures get all that high, but definitely there's regional or local areas where you can get those hotspots.
SAR in general, or I should say tissue warming in general, is usually more peripheral, right? I mean, isn't it more of a function of just a magnetic induction, you know, the magnetic field at that frequencies that we operate does in fact induce currents, low level currents, which result in this induction and heating, therefore.
Yeah, that's correct. And it tends to be more on the surface of the body, so less in our core and more on the surface. And that's actually a good thing, because our body has thermoregulatory mechanisms. It can actually increase blood perfusion to those surface tissues and help with the cooling. And so that's actually it's sort of, even though most of the energy gets deposited there, there's actually an increase in a cooling effect that can occur and help keep that those temperatures lower.
That's interesting.
With regard to the hotspots, I want to get back to that. Because the RF is non-uniform, then these hotspots would be dependent on different tissue conductivity in various areas? Would that affect where these occur?
Exactly. So it's the electrical conductivity, it's the different types of tissues, it's the shape of the tissue. So you can get, for instance, when you're doing head scanning, you can get, they're sort of warmer locations that can be in the lower neck and shoulders, for example. So again, usually we have the limits on how much SAR we can use. And most of the time our patients shouldn't feel that. But again, you can get warm areas.
Would the presence of an implant or device or metallic item affect RF power deposition in and around that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. So if you have any kind of metallic implant, and it really depends on the type of implant you have and the details of how it's constructed. And there's a number of things that go into it, but definitely you can induce currents or induce voltages on that implant from the RF power, and it can basically focus the heat around that implant.
Is that more for active implants or passive?
You can really get it with both. I would say one reason why active implants are bad is because a lot of times they have very long leads. So things like pacemakers and deep brain stimulators have long leads, and typically the longer the lead, the worse chance you have for having some sort of coupling or power deposition around that.
Now, that's interesting, because we know that lead lengths make a difference based upon field strength. Do you want to speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, correct. So there can be a number of different field strengths for MRI. I'm most familiar at our institution, we have 1.5T and 3T MRI systems. And you know, because of the higher field strength, the resonant frequency of our spins is higher. And so we have to use radio frequency energy that has twice the frequency, or that corresponds to one half of the wavelength. And so when you get that shorter wavelength, that can actually make it easier to couple that energy into the implant. It's not always the case that 3T is worse, but a lot of times it is the case that implant is close to the length that's bad for 3T. But again, it could happen at 1.5T as well. So it's not a hard and fast rule.
So Bill and I've heard that at 3 Tesla, it's approximately 12.5 centimeters to 15, whereas when you decrease the field strength, let's say go 1.5, it's more like 25 to 30 centimeters. Do you have any recommendations as far as that, or?
As far as lead length?
Yes.
Yeah, it's, again, if you get a dimension that's close to that, it can be worse and couple into it, but you can't purely rely on that because there are a number of factors that play into it. So even for shorter implants, you could still have some heating.
Okay.
Would that be because depending on the shape, size of the tissue, and to a certain extent, the makeup of the tissue, that can alter the wavelength of the RF pulse, correct? So that's why those limits are just kind of not arbitrary, but they're very ballpark.
Yeah, they're very ballpark. Yeah, that's correct. You have different tissues in your body. You have areas of muscle and fat, and you have air in the lungs, and so that can definitely affect how that the RF energy couples into those implants.
And presumably, Carl, it depends on which coil you're using. Most of the time, we're using the body coil to transmit, but obviously, we'd have fewer problems with, say, a transmit-receive head coil or something like that, although we'd have more problems because of the length of the scan.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it's any, we typically use the body coil for transmit, so almost, I would say, at least at our institution, most of our coils are receive-only coils, and so we use the body coil for transmit. And as Howard mentioned, sometimes if you use a head-only coil, or say you're doing an extremity and can use a knee or a foot transmit coil, then that'll help you, and you won't get that RF energy. You know, if the device is not inside that coil, then you're not going to get that coupling in there like that.
Howard, one of our previous episodes, you and I were talking with Vera about non-labeled pacemakers and stuff. And one of the things that brought that back to me, and I'd like to get your comments on this. In Kristen and I's MR Safety Officer, MRMD course, we've got a slide that was provided for us by Dr. Frank Shellock. And I don't know exactly what paper this was from, or if this was just from an internal thing he did, one of his testings that he's done. My understanding, if I can describe it, it shows the heating, measured heating with a pacing wire without a pulse generator attached. So in other words, it essentially would be like an abandoned pacing wire. And this was a heating test. And he scanned it at 1.5 Tesla. And Kristen, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe the numbers were at 1.5 Tesla. It was scanned at 1.4 watts per kilogram or something like that.
That's correct. And, yeah, that's correct.
Okay. And then at 3 Tesla, it was scanned at 3.2 watts per kilogram. So at 3 Tesla, it was essentially scanned within the first level control mode. Then at 1.5, it was scanned in the well within the normal operating mode, well below 2 watts per kilogram. And the item, the lead did not heat at all at 3T, but it heated tremendously and quickly at 1.5, and it was because it matched that resonant length. You had that resonant coupling. I don't know if you've seen that particular illustration, Carl, or familiar with it, or Howard. You know, that's one of the things that came to my mind when we were talking about the non-labeled pacemakers, and you mentioned specifically that one of the things that at your shop that you did not like to do was abandon pacing leads.
And that's mainly because, Carl, with the help of the Heart Rhythm Society, we've developed those guidelines, and we pay close attention to what devices are left in fragments, and especially those that aren't attached to pacer devices. Carl, do you have a little skinny on it for us that you can fill us in?
Yes, definitely. So, yeah, that's an uncommon occurrence, Bill. I would say that it's worse at 1.5T, but it definitely can happen, as you mentioned, if the resonant length is closer to that 1.5T wavelength, that can happen, that it's actually worse at 1.5T. And that's why it's important to test devices that we see in our patients, that they be tested and that they have good MR conditional labeling as well. And for a case like abandoned leads, there's not a lot of data like that. So As you mentioned, an abandoned lead can be worse than one connected to a generator. And one reason is that, the lead changes the resonant length of it when you connect it to the generator. And there's some filters in that generator that can help dissipate some of the currents that get induced. So those are some reasons why it can be more tricky with abandoned leads.
So, Carl, I know that SAR in general is estimated. It's not something that's calculated. And I want to get you to speak to that a little bit in terms of what goes into that. But, everybody needs to understand that every vendor has their own proprietary algorithm for how they estimate SAR.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So each vendor has their own method of calculating SAR or estimating SAR. And as you mentioned, mostly it's calculated or they may do a phantom experiment of some sort to get a sense of, how much RF power corresponds to how much heating and how much SAR. But then they have to try to make that work for a large number of patients and different pulse sequences. And so, typically when you're doing the scan prescription, it's estimating the SAR that you're going to get. And there is a way that it has a rough measurement of SAR during the scan. So the scanner will actually measure how much power is going into the patient and divide that by the patient's weight. And you can estimate how much power is going into the patient. That's more of a safety backup. That's not really necessarily that precise. But again, it's each manufacturer, as you mentioned, has a different way of estimating SAR, and they can vary between manufacturer and even between different scans for that manufacturer.
And it has a lot of practical benefits or detriments too, a lot of implications of how they do that, because at least with the more modern modeling, we've seen that they're not only checking the SAR, which they should, but they're also in some cases in the background without you really knowing what's going on. They're modifying the pulse sequences to space out TRs and so forth. And suddenly you've got an infant on the table and your axial T2 normally takes a minute and now it's taking 4 minutes. And some of that is this SAR modeling influencing then how the machine actually works, or even in some cases will shut down for you if you've exceeded some limit. And so it has tremendous implications, especially if you're looking at small children at 3T, for example.
So that's, would everyone agree that in very general sense, all the manufacturers use extremely, extremely conservative SAR estimates, and probably because of the variability in the patient population?
Yeah, I would say that's what I've heard as well, is that it is pretty conservative, tend to underestimate SAR a little bit. And so I shouldn't say a little bit, as you mentioned, it is more conservative than that. Again, because there's a wide number of patients and they're trying to, make sure that the risk of anything going wrong for any particular patient is quite low.
Okay, so I do have another question about SAR and Carl, Howard, pipe in here. Any recommendations on certain pulse sequences that you would use over others as far as helping to manage SAR and to decrease the amount of tissue heating?
Yeah, so yeah, anytime that, this often occurs and we have an implant that has a SAR limitation of some sort, and as Howard mentioned, that you can, the higher SAR sequences can really slow down our scans in some situations. And so some sequences that are really bad for SAR, we'll start with those first, are things like fast spin echo scans that have a lot of radio frequency pulses in them. And then some things that are better are things like gradient echo scans. Something like echoplanar imaging, for example, is a little surprising because it sounds like it's a really fast sequence, but it actually doesn't use a lot of radio frequency. And there are some newer kind of FSE fast spin echo like scans. So some of the 3D fast spin echo scans like the cube or the space sequences actually lower the flip angles quite a bit, and that can actually help you with your SAR as well.
That's good to know.
I've actually heard that these 3D fast spin echoes, surprisingly, are relatively SAR friendly compared to the other standard sequences.
Yeah, it is a little surprising on first glance. You think that it's a pretty advanced sequence and it would need a lot of RF energy. It does have a lot of RF pulses, but they tend to be really pretty low flip angles. And so that really helps you.
gradient echoes seem to be, you know, low SAR, but I've also heard, and I've been under the impression that a sequence, for example, balanced gradient echo, which would be called Fiesta, TrueFISP, and some of SSFP, the balanced gradient echoes, because they're really quick, I mean, like TRs on the order of 7, things like that, and their flip angles for that low TR are relatively high, like 45 and things like that, they can have a actually pretty high SAR value, correct?
That's correct, yeah. Those balanced fast field echo or TrueFISP or Fiesta sequences that the different vendors call them, as you mentioned, they have very short TRs, they go very fast, and they actually have very high flip angles, so high RF power. So you actually can get very high SAR with them as well, as you mentioned.
Let's move into kind of the next one.
Okay, so and I'll go ahead and pronounce them since you have trouble with getting that.
Yeah, why don't you tell us what we're about to go into next since I can't seem to say it.
I know, we've all noticed that. So now we're going to talk about SED, also known as SAE. So SED is specific energy dose. And here you go, Bill, listen, write it down. The next one is specific absorbed energy, because referred to in both ways. Seems to be on the systems, they say SED, but in a lot of the papers that are written, it's specific absorbed energy.
Yeah, what you said.
So Carl, give us the overview here of exactly what is SED and SAE.
Yeah, so as we've been discussing, the SAR is a power deposition, so watts per kilogram. And basically, you know, if you scan continuously or if you scan long enough, you're going to put a total amount of energy into your patient. And so the SAE or the SED is how much total energy that you've put into your patient. And it's simply, you're just basically multiplying your sequence with how much SAR it has times the time for that sequence. And you get a number, instead of in watts per kilogram, it actually, it's in joules or kilojoules per kilogram.
So the SAR is really the rate at which the energy goes in, and the SED or the SAE is the total dose delivered because of the duration of that particular pulse sequence.
Some years ago, and I want to say it was around 2014, but I may be wrong, I want to refer to a paper that, for folks listening, will be in our list of references. We got a list of about 5 references for you on the podcast webpage. But one of these papers that came out really stirred a lot of controversy, because it was basically saying that their modeling, their experiments, and this again was completely done in laboratory in anatomic models, not in patients, that there were concerns that if you reach a certain SED level, that you can actually cause tissue damage. And at one point, the IEC required the vendors to limit the amount of SED that occurred. And when it reached a certain point, it would basically stop scanning. It would just cut off and go, you can't scan anymore.
Now, Bill,
you're done for that patient.
You can't pronounce it. A lot of people don't know these 3-letter acronyms. So IEC stands for International Electrotechnical Commission.
Right. And again, Carl, correct me if I was wrong, if that's not who did it, but is that kind of what happened back in the mid-2000s or 2010s?
I think that's essentially what happened. I don't know the full exact history of it, but definitely the IEC did recommend a limit. And my understanding is that the limit they proposed, they thought, well, no one is ever going to hit this limit. and it turns out that occasionally we do hit that limit.
They don't scan with the people we scan with.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I'll just say a word. The limit that they proposed was 14.4 kilojoules per kilogram, I think is the number. And basically, if you multiply the number out, that's basically if you scanned at 4 watts per kilogram nonstop without any breaks at all for 1 hour, then you would hit that limit. And that's not something that we do a lot in clinical practice. But I would say that even if you don't hit that limit at 1 hour, you can hit that limit after 2 or 3 hours. And again, that's not a common scenario, but that does happen sometimes.
So, Carl, for example, I come from a big pediatric background, and we're neuro, and maybe Howard, you want to speak to this, but brain tumor follow-ups, you know, you're getting, it's a very long scan time, at least.
Especially brain and spine.
Yeah, and then you do the contrast looking for the drop mets. And so I hear a lot of people, they call it like setting out, or, you know, it stops them from imaging for 24 hours. And so how do you work with that? Because there's a lot of controversy around this.
There is, yes. And it is difficult to work with. And as you mentioned, it for us at least, it also happens mostly with our with some pediatric patients.
And neuro, we're difficult to work with in general, though. But kidding aside, I mean, I think it really comes back to maintaining and pruning and, taking care of your protocols over time and recognizing, especially with the modern controls on these scanners, you may not be able to do your traditional one, or you may need to, for example, change the order so that you're alternating gradient echo and spin echo type sequences to try to keep that overall SAR and SED down to a reasonable level, even for long scans.
Do all vendors take time into account?
That's a good question. I'm most familiar with one vendor, and I know that our vendor does. One issue we have is that limit is just one number, and it's the same number no matter how fast you run the scans, if you have breaks in between. And it's also the same number if you have the size of your patients. And it really, that paper that you mentioned, Bill, talks about some of those different scenarios. And again, we don't have a lot of work a lot of research as to what that said limit should be. But it would be nice if there was more work, because it's feasible perhaps that number could actually be a lot longer for our pediatric patients.
I have also heard that the IEC was backing off on the requirement for a hard stop, that they were now leaning more toward putting a warning on the scanner or something, goes, by the way, you've reached this, you know, just letting you know, and leave it up to the radiologist to decide whether to continue. Howard, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's probably more sensible. When you think about it, a lot of these little ones might also be under general anesthesia. And then you're talking about balancing the risk of anesthesia, which has its own significant risks and expense, versus, you know, potentially heating up just a little bit more. And I think I've heard you, Bill, say, you know, it's kind of funny, you get a neonate from the ICU and you're in there and they're worried about the baby heating up because of SAR, and then they rush them back to put them in an incubator to keep them warm.
Yeah. Now, the last thing I want to address before we get out of here is something that has always been around. It's just now coming to the forefront for use with some implants and devices, and we'll start to see this as a condition of use more and more, and that's B1 plus RMS, which, as I understand it, B1 plus RMS is part of all vendor SAR estimations, because it's a measurement of the actual strength of the magnetic field of the RF being applied. Is that correct, Carl?
Yes, that's correct. So it's, as you mentioned, it's a measure of the RF field that's applied. And so we call that the B1 field. And the RMS basically means that it's an average over the, let's say, the duration of our TR, or the average over our pulse sequence. Can be a similar time scale, and it's a measure of that. But it's, the good thing about it is it actually is very it more kind of accurately tells you what's going on from a magnetic and a electromagnetic point of view in the body, and if you have an implant at that implant. And it's not dependent on patient size, or it's not dependent even on vendor. Each vendor should have the same number for that.
Well, as I understand it, it's again a measure. It's in units of microtesla, correct? Which is the actual strength of the B1 field.
That's correct. Yes, the B1 field is, you know, it's a much weaker field than our main magnetic field, which is in teslas. But the B1 field, the microtesla is that's correct. Is the right measure.
So then, you know,
go ahead, Bill.
Well, I was going to say, so, you know, a 1.8, just making up a number, 1.8 microtesla on a GE is 1.8 microtesla on Siemens, and 1.8 microtesla on Philips, and 1.8 microtesla is 1.8 microtesla on me, Carl, Kristen, and Howard. It's irrespective of the patient and the vendor.
That's correct. Yeah. The scanner, when you do the scan, it still has to you know, calibrate that correctly, but assuming it does the calibrations correctly, it should be very close to that. Yeah.
And can you explain to us the positive, as far as the positively rotating component, and what that means for everyone?
Yeah. What's the plus thing?
Yeah. So the plus just means that when you have your transmit B1, if you think back to your MR physics days, you know that our spins are rotating at a certain frequency. So at 1.5 T, it's around 64 megahertz. So it's rotating at that frequency. And when we apply our radio frequency pulse, we want basically, you can think of it as the polarization of that pulse is also, we want that locked into that frequency as well. And so that's, we call that the positive rotating part of that. And so that's what the plus means. And we don't want the negative, because negative rotates the other way. And that doesn't help us at all as far as for our RF transmission and excitation.
The other thing that I think is important when we compare B1 plus RMS, which you're seeing more and more with conditional devices, it gives you a lot more flexibility than SAR does as far as optimizing your protocol. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, that's very important. I would say that we're still waiting for a lot of the device vendors to pick up on B1 plus RMS, but a lot of them are. There are a lot of devices that are labeled with that. And sometimes you'll see, for example, that it's labeled both with a B1 plus RMS limit and also with a SAR limit. And as you mentioned, the B1 plus RMS can be more flexible, and the SAR limit is typically very conservative for the device as well. Just as we mentioned, because you have so much variation in MRI vendor manufacturer and size of patient and so on, they have to make the SAR limit very conservative. But again, because the B1 plus RMS limit is much more consistent, you can actually run at higher speeds or higher flip angles with that and have faster scans if you use a B1 plus RMS limit.
So that's one of the things that we, you know, when we're again teaching in our courses, it's like, you know, really good thing about it, if you've got that value, you can build a protocol, and as long as you don't change any parameters that affect the B1 plus RMS, which by the way are the same parameters that affect SAR, like TR, number of slices per TR, flip angle, you know, the type of the pulse, that sort of thing. As long as you don't change any of that, then that will always be at that particular B1 plus RMS value, regardless of the patient you put in there. So it's much easier to tailor the protocols because it doesn't take any patient things into account. It's strictly just the parameters.
Yeah, that's reasonable, definitely. Yep.
You know, Carl, as a physicist, when you step back and take all the things we talked about today, SAR, SED, and B1 plus RMS, can you give us just some big picture comments on how you translate that into protocols in special situations, conditional, low SAR, short duration, vagal nerve stimulators, deep brain stimulators, external orthopedic fixation devices going into the bore? Do you have any take home messages for us on kind of a smart way to use these metrics in designing protocols and order?
Yeah, that's a big list of devices, Howard. And so, yeah, definitely for devices, we want to see that they have some sort of MR conditional labeling. And so we want to see either a SAR limit or a B1 plus RMS limit. And if they have that B1 plus RMS limit, that's really helpful to use that. And we can use that to help design our sequences. And again, many devices don't have that kind of labeling, so we have to rely on our SAR labeling. And when we go to the scanner and we type in our prescription, we should be able to see, you know, what is the estimated SAR or the estimated B1 plus RMS is a label given by the scanner a lot of times now, and use that to help design our sequences. We can to try to, you know, let's say we have a device where that has a fairly harsh limit on those things, and we need to do some things to try to, with our pulse sequences, to try to get those to run in a reasonable scan time, so we can do things like lower flip angles if we can. We may have to, if we have a T2 weighted scan and we're trying to get under our SAR limit, we may have to actually increase the TR quite a bit just to meet that limit. So there's a number of things that we can do, or we may have to even decrease matrix size or something to cut the scan time if we're running into a big limit.
Well, you know, Carl, one of the real hot topics and quite important right now with our COVID epidemic is that we're bringing in personal protective equipment like masks that may be made in an atypical factory. We don't know exactly what's in them. For that matter, ventilators coming in that may not be MR conditional or compatible. Personnel are being redeployed who aren't used to working in the MR environment necessarily and may not be fully safety trained. So we've got a lot of hazards on top of the usual ones. I'm just curious how you as a physicist see we can maintain safety in this this environment.
Yes, Howard. Yeah, that's a very important issue. And so, as you mentioned, with the PPE, you know, there's some discussion right now as to what PPE can go into the scanner environment. So just for our listeners, just to be aware that a lot of that PPE may have metallic clips or staples in it. Just be aware of that. There could be some could be not ferromagnetic, but some could be ferromagnetic again, because some of the stuff that we're starting to see is sort of our things that are non-standard. And as you mentioned, with ventilators as well, as we're seeing vendors that are, they're starting to make some of these devices in car factories and other automobile factories, other locations that don't normally see that. So again, just be diligent to the devices that are allowed into the MRI scanner room. And also, as you mentioned, to the people that are coming into our suite, just make sure they're screened appropriately and trained appropriately to work in the MRI system.
I think it's important also to one point I wanted to emphasize there, that if you have, some of these masks and things that have metallic items on them, it's important to remember that not all metal is ferromagnetic, but all metal is conductive. And so, you know, we've been talking about RF, and then some of the things that can happen with burn can happen if you have conductive metals in the bore. So just because it's not ferromagnetic doesn't mean it doesn't pose a hazard.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Bill.
All right. So I think we're about to end this MRI cast. And I think that all of us want to thank all of you that are on the front lines taking care of the patients, and we just want to make sure you take care of yourselves, and we just really extend our appreciation for all that you're doing. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks everyone very much. And that brings us to the end of this MRI cast episode. I want to thank my co-host, Kristen Harrington. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you.
And Dr. Howard Raleigh. Thank you, Howard.
Thanks so much, Bill.
And a special thanks to Dr. Carl Vegan for providing some excellent information here. I know I personally have learned a lot. Thank you very much, Carl, for joining us.
Thank you, Bill. Carl. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, you've been fantastic. A great addition as far as the information you provided today. So thank you.
Thank you. I don't want anybody to hire Carl away from us, by the way.
not for hire.
His LinkedIn is like highlighting right now.
That's right.
Messages coming in, Howard. So it's your own fault, Howard.
Dang it.
Well, that brings us to the end of this MRI cast. Again, I want to thank everybody. We want to thank Bracco Diagnostics for their support through their unrestricted educational grant. So until next time, this is Bill Faulkner on behalf of myself, Kristen Harrington, Howard Raleigh, and Dr. Carl Vegan. Thank you all again for listening. Take care. Be safe. You've been listening to MRI Cast. This program is made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics.